This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. This is Dr. Jonathan Abel, and I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about today is an issue that I would say the U.S. Army of the 2020s is very interested in, and that is how you go from a small, professional, elite army to one that can fight what we would now refer to as a multi-domain, large-scale combat operations. And the example we're going to use is the largest army the United States has ever created, or I should say largest military, the one in World War II. So what I want to start with, Dr. Nance, is the 1920s is a period of austerity. The Republican presidents and Congresses don't want to spend a lot of money. It's kind of the Calvin Coolidge, you know, the business of America is business era. So what does that mean for the U.S. Army?
Okay, so I'll start with kind of pushing back on the comment you said, a small elite force.
Yeah.
Elite only in perhaps that it's a small group of people. This is not to say that the U.S. Army was comprised of a bunch of amateurs and rookies, but it the way you get good at things is to do it.
Right.
And so what you had is that the Army downsized fairly dramatically after the First World War. And acquisition was just not something that was done, acquiring new equipment. And what that meant is that you could play with things like airplanes and you could get things like tanks, but you weren't getting a lot of any one particular item and you weren't getting the money to operate said equipment a lot. Mm-hmm. In addition, training large numbers of soldiers costs money. You know, you've got to pay for, you know, food, tentage, all that kind of things. And so they're not doing a lot. They're not doing a huge amount of training. They're not buying new equipment, and they're not really bringing a lot of folks. Now, one of the interesting things is we do end up with a reasonably modern doctrine, if you would want to use that term, which is Field Service Regulations 1923. Comes after the National Defense Act of 1920, I want to say, which kind of codifies a couple things. One of them is the tanks belong to the infantry, heaven forfend. And the reason is because Field Service Regulations 1923, which comes from this, is we basically took French doctrine, mostly French, some Brits and some of our own, but there's a lot of French influence there, from 1917, 1918, basically translated into English, copy-pasted.
Right.
Now, there's some detail work in there that some experts in that area could kind of point out, but that's kind of what it looked like, which is it looked a lot like deliberate battle. Lavish use of artillery and firepower, phase line movement, soldiers moving forward as they go forward. Now, that doctrine requires a lot of stuff that we weren't willing to pay for.
And it's worth pointing out, we didn't have a lot of in World War I because we used a lot of French equipment.
Right, and the acquisition. But we did a lot of people. Yes. And one of the things the French and the British were very positive about us in 1917. Oh, look at all the Americans.
Right.
But the idea being is that we knew that we had the doctrine that we were reasonably comfortable with. And we had a fairly experienced officer corps. As an example, General Simpson, who I've talked about extensively, he started the war as a captain in 1917. He ended the war as a lieutenant colonel, division chief of staff. In 1919, he reverted to captain and then was promoted immediately to major.
Mm-hmm.
Long story behind that we don't need to get into. But what that meant is that he'd been a division chief of staff before he attended the American Command and General Staff College. kind of an interesting perspective. And that he was not the Lone Ranger. There were lots of officers like him in the force.
Yeah.
So what we had in the 20s and leading in on into the 30s is we had a fairly experienced and capable, call it senior field grade corps,
right.
And some generals. Bear in mind that because authorizations were not high, a lot of these guys are just kind of sticking around. We did not have today's up or out. So you could spend a decade or more at a particular rank waiting for basically more positions to be authorized by Congress.
And if I remember correctly from my reading of this period, as limited as it is, it was almost like it's a family business. Like, it was kind of who you knew was how you got promotions once somebody did vacate a slot.
No, it was all based on seniority. There is some personality stuff in terms of who gets what assignments. Mm. That's probably what you've seen right there.
Yeah.
Like, as a for instance, if you had a good professional reputation, if you were seen as an up-and-comer, one of the places you got sent was China. We had the 15th Infantry Regiment that was out there in, I want to say, Tientsin. Dr. Babb can make fun of my Chinese pronunciation later. But that was kind of where you'd send some up-and-comers. Like, so assignments were there, but promotions were all based off of where you were in the order of merit. And this goes all the way back, in most cases, because these are this is still the regular army of the pre-World War II era. I hesitate to throw a percentage out, but it's not. I would feel comfortable saying anywhere from 85 to 90% of them were West Pointers.
Yeah.
Easily.
And probably a few scattered, like, VMI types.
Some VMI, Marshall being a good example. Some VMI types.
But I think the thing for modern people to understand is there is no ROTC yet.
Well, interesting enough, yes but no. So the Reserve Officer Training Corps, in the name, was established by the National Defense Act of, I want to say, 1916.
Mm-hmm.
But in the name, it was to create officers for the reserve.
Right.
And the idea is that, hey, congratulations, super high performers might get active duty. I'd have to go back and look and see how much there was of that. But most of these guys, when they would be commissioned, when they would graduate from wherever, is they would revert back to civilian life, waiting for the call to come.
Unlike today, where I think less than 10% of officers are Service Academy graduates the Army.
That sounds right. I don't have the numbers right in front of me.
So but just so we know, this is a vastly different officer corps.
Right. So we have this officer corps, but so they all kind of know each other.
Right.
And but the seniority in some cases goes all the way back to their class rank in the academy.
Right.
When you have a bunch of lieutenants all graduating on the same day, how do you differentiate who is highest in the class?
Right.
And now this can change over time depending on other things, but in some cases not. For instance, when we were both captains, my wife was actually senior to me as a captain because she had graduated from the academy higher in rank than I was.
Having met both of you, that checks out.
Yep, I would agree.
So we've got this army that is small. As you mentioned, at least its leadership, I think we can say, is elite, because it is, you know, it's largely West Point.
Reasonably well, yes.
So let's fast forward a little bit with these guys who, you know, they may have a tank. We start to see problems first domestically when the economy crashes in late 29-30, and then we start to see problems in Europe with the rise of extremist ideologies like Mussolini's fascism and then National Socialism in Germany. There's an ongoing issue with communism in Russia. It looks more and more like the United States may not fight a European war, but at least needs to be ready for something. So how do we move into that kind of storm clouds era?
Okay, so this starts, call it early 30s. Interesting that the Army, in some ways, they felt the Depression a little, perhaps less deeply than maybe some civilians because they were already in austerity.
Well, it's also kind of distasteful to say, but economic downturns tend to be good for recruiting.
There's that, although bear in mind they didn't have a lot of their authorizations were still not up, which is they were not, they had, or they were authorized a certain amount, but Congress was not paying them enough to get to fill units up to full strength. Also, three hots in a cot beats living in a Hooverville.
Right. That's true.
So, but long story short is that the Army is starting to see these come up. And just because they don't have a lot of funding doesn't mean they're doing nothing. They're not sitting on their hands. All the way back into the 20s, guys like Patton and Eisenhower, who served together at what was then Fort Benning, now Fort Moore in Georgia, they were experimenting with tanks. What can these do? What can they not do? As they're kind of playing with things.
Now, are we talking? So these guys are probably mid-career officers at this point, maybe headed towards senior. Are we talking like how fast can this tank drive? Or are we talking like how can an armor brigade maneuver?
More the first than the second at Benning.
Right.
This is what can a tank do on a steep slope? What are the things that this can and cannot do? Where you talk about where an armor brigade you can maneuver, that's what's happening out at Fort Knox. So at Fort Knox, there is a armor brigade that's not an armor brigade. Because again, remember, according to the National Defense Act of 1920, tanks belong to the infantry.
Right.
So the cavalry creates things that look a lot like tanks, but we call them combat cars.
Right.
And the 7th Cavalry Brigade is experimenting with all these different things. It starts with the 1st Cavalry Regiment, then they grow to include the 13th Cavalry Regiment as well. So the 7th Cavalry Brigade is formed. And we're starting to experiment with these things. So we're also not sitting on our hands in terms of the intellectual development of the Army. People are sitting around thinking the deep thoughts about how to do this. If you read the branch journals from this time frame, there's a lot of fairly standard branch journal stuff. We did this exercise. This is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's true in 1920 as it is in 2025.
Right.
But the larger idea is that they're also sitting there going, what can tanks do? Are tanks just infantry support platforms? What do airplanes do? Talking about how you fight in these new things. How do you hide a cavalry column of horses from aerial observation? All of these things are going on, and they're talking about it in branch journals. They're writing about it. The letters columns get vociferous as people fight back and forth. And this is not just, as you might imagine, the reactionaries versus the visionaries. These are instead very motivated, very professional disagreements over very valid issues on both sides.
Yeah, and I put a plug in here for people who are interested in any period of military kind of reform or debate. Look at the service journals, because the debates people often want to know about are had in those journals, and they're had publicly. That's the thing I think it's important, is that these are published.
Yeah, these are letters, and this is all the way from captains and majors and lieutenant colonels and colonels. Not a lot of lieutenants are writing.
But at least it's open if they want to.
And they're reading.
Yeah.
So also we're sending a lot of these officers, because again, what do you do with a major that's been a lieutenant colonel and has been a division chief of staff? Well, what you do is, first off, you send him to your schooling to get him caught up on your approach to doing things.
Right.
And then you keep them as instructors. So all of these guys, and Simpson again, I know him off the top of my head because the research I've done with him, he goes to the Command General Staff College, gets a second year, then stays on as an instructor, then goes into the War College, and then stays on as an instructor. You're seeing these guys spend all this time doing instructor duty, and to kind of the first part to answer to your question is that as they see the storm clouds gathering, is they're starting to really do the intellectual work in terms of, okay, how are we going to fight with the modern emerging technology and the maturing technology,
right,
that we see coming out there.
So you say something interesting that I want to pull on. A lot of what you're talking about is kind of Army internal, right? And it may take inputs from, for example, things that European militaries are doing. But what is the mission of the U.S. Army in the early 1930s? Where is it postured and who is it looking at?
Okay. A couple different places. The most visible mission of the United States Army in the 20s and the 30s is the Mexican border. And that is predominantly horse cavalry regiments strewn out on a series of small little border forts all the way from Brownsville all the way to California.
Right.
And
these are places like Fort Huachuca?
Yeah, Fort Huachuca, Fort Bliss. Fort Davis, Bings, but I don't know if that's right. But
yeah,
pick any place in the Rio Grande Valley with fort in it, and there you go, right?
Right.
And these are not big places, and these are not, like, ideal duty stations.
They're also not near anything.
No. And really what they're doing is they're patrolling the border. This is less of an immigration issue, which modern listeners might think of, and much more of a security issue because Mexico is is basically, at this point, not quite a failed state, but kind of the next thing above it.
Well, and Mexico had invaded the U.S. in the prior decade.
Yes, Pancho Villa. And the idea being is it's basically keeping a lot of the chaos and banditry that is going on in Mexico kind of on the Mexican side of the border.
Right. Okay, so that's mission number one.
Yeah. And the other mission is the second mission, which is kind of the foreign army, particularly the Pacific. Is where you really see this. That's where the U.S. Army is forward deployed. You have the Philippines, you have Hawaii, sort of. There's U.S. Army defending Hawaii.
Right.
And then you got but the really big ones are the Philippines and then the 15th Infantry Regiment out in China.
Yeah.
And they stay there, God, I'd have to go back and take a look, but they stay there.
Yeah, I think it's after the war breaks out in Asia.
But the Philippines is kind of the big place. Now, interestingly enough, most of the American, you can't see the air quotes, but air quotes, American forces there are actually Filipinos with American equipment.
Yeah, and the Philippines at this point are an American Commonwealth, so they're basically Puerto Rico.
Don't know, there might be some legal what have yous, but the idea basically being is that the Philippines have kind of their own armed forces that are under under American auspices and under American command.
Now, the U.S. had also fought a war against indigenous Filipino elements, further back than the Mexico issue, but are the forces in the Philippines designed to do internal things, or are they truly postured outward?
Yes and yes. So they're still fighting that. I mean, there's kind of always been fighting on Mindanao. Which is the southern island in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
The Moros, the local forces or the local people in that island have resisted pretty much all outward invaders.
They don't like being run by people who are not Moros.
They fight the Spanish, they fight the Americans, they fight the current Philippine government in many ways.
Yep.
So that's not a new problem. So, yes, there's some internal security, but for the most part, the Philippine forces are being trained, equipped, and organized to defend the Philippines against an external invasion,
so,
which in the 1930s, no one is making any bones about it. That will be the Japanese army, and it will come from Japan.
So they're training to do what we would call MDO and not COIN.
For the most part, okay. Yes.
So we have kind of this schizophrenic posture, and you mentioned that a lot of the Philippine forces are indigenous Filipino, particularly the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect these guys who are, you know, driving tanks around Kentucky, or does it?
It doesn't. So it's really three different armies. You've got the border army, you've got the overseas army, and you have kind of the guys in Kentucky. Brian Lynn has done some really good work talking about the interwar army. So if anybody's interested in taking a look at it, I highly recommend looking at his work.
Everything Brian Lynn does.
That is a good point. Nice gentleman, too. But
very nice guy. Yeah.
He was very kind when I met him a couple times. So, yeah. But the idea being is that you have kind of the Army of the Interior, and they're thinking what we would today call multi-domain operations, or large-scale combat operations. They're thinking about a war in Europe.
Okay.
You have the guys on the border that are basically doing the same mission that has been going on for hundreds of years. And then you have the Philippine and foreign army who are focused on those specific things.
Yeah.
And you might bounce around in a career. You might hit a couple of those different spots. But again, talking about kind of who you know, it kind of depends on what kind of circle of the army you kind of end up in, depending on where you spend a lot of your time.
Yeah. So obviously we don't have a Pentagon yet or a Joint Chiefs. How is the headquarters of the Army handling these three different distinct missions? Or does it just compartmentalize them?
Without a broad perspective, it's just this is handling this, this is handling that, that's handling that. They're not spending a lot of time with it.
So they're not, for example, saying to, you know, the Fort Knox people, Japan is the pacing threat, plan against that.
No, they're what they are planning for. They don't have to tell the Fort Knox guys this, if that makes sense. Is the Army, and you can look at this with the color plans that come up during this time frame, and then turn into the rainbow plans. The Army is under no illusions as to who they're going to have to fight by the 1930s.
Right.
They know. I mean, it's in all the documentation. And it's very clear, like the Naval War College, they are planning to fight the German fleet and the Japanese fleet. The Army is preparing to mostly fight the Germans. There's some talk about War Plan Red, which is to fight the British in the 1920s. But that's more along the lines of, I think, a planner needed something to do.
Planners always need things to do.
But I don't know how seriously that was ever taken.
One planner took it seriously.
but the idea is that in the 1930s, going back to like how we're getting ready for this,
right,
is the planners are looking very seriously at how we're looking at this. There's another thing going on during this time frame. So we're reading and writing. We're sending people to schools. We're handling these kind of three missions that are going out. Well, two missions, and then trying to get whatever training you can in the interior of the U.S.
Right.
But we've also got another thing going on in the 1930s, which is, you talked about the Depression going on. FDR is going to have the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Civilians Military Training Corps, which I think we talked a little bit about with Dr. Nagel a while ago. But the interesting thing about that is that the Civilian Conservation Corps is much bigger. But what they're doing is that the Army, FDR is looking for some people to kind of manage this, and where else are you going to find a large group of fairly qualified people who understand how to organize large groups of folks and do that?
Right.
So they're going to use that.
Right.
Which the Army is not, depending on who you ask in the Army, they're more or less thrilled about it.
Right.
But the idea being is that what they really are, but what it really is it's a rep in how to bring in folks. Because what you have is, we talked about that cadre of, we'll call it elite. I would push, the only reason I push back against elite is that some of them were better than others. But you had a cadre of experience.
Right.
What was lack, and then you had some senior NCOs. However, the soldier level was not necessarily well trained, and that's not necessarily their fault. They were very capable, perhaps, just they didn't have the opportunity to train.
Right.
And this is doubly so for the National Guard, which we can talk about more in a second. Because if you think the active army is unfunded, you just wait till you see the Guard.
Right.
But the Army defense policy, almost from Jump Street, was, and this goes back all the way to Upton, and going way back, is the idea of an expansible army.
Right.
For those of us that have remembered our American history from the late 19th century.
So this is basically draw a box on a board somewhere, it's empty, assign it a command staff, and it theoretically exists. And then when the crisis comes, then you man it.
Yes. And the idea is that this is why Congress actually authorized a greater percentage of officers than were actually needed to man the Army as it was in the 20s and the 30s.
To build the scale on paper.
Right. Which is, you're going to have majors, lieutenant colonels, and colonels. And we had more of those than we truly needed for the 20s and the 30s. But when all of a sudden we have to go to war, all these draftees are going to come up, and the expectation is that all these guys are just going to fleet up and command larger organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to have them available, because even today, with our admittedly faster careers in a lot of ways, also shorter careers in many ways, some of these guys, like Simpson, had been in the Army 30 years
right
by the time World War II kicked off in Europe.
Right.
That would have been kind of unheard of in today's Army for a guy that, for a one star to just be making one star at 30 years.
Right.
But the idea being is, we take all these, is we're going to bring in all these draftees, But a major takes 20, a major will take 10 to 12 years in modern terms to make.
Or even if you do it very, very quickly, we're still talking like 5 to 7.
Right. And the idea being is that, okay, you can pin an oak leaf on someone and call them a major. However, there's a certain amount of professional experience and training and maturity that you want to have in a field grade officer. And that just takes time to make. Now, in a wartime environment, can you make them faster? Sure, and we did. But the idea being is that, at least to start off, that guy that you're going to pin rank on and say, hey, I know you've been in the Army for 5 years, but congratulations, you're a battalion commander now.
Right.
As Dick Winters from Band of Brothers, he still has to have that long service professional to at least model himself after at a certain point.
So let's close the loop on something we talked about earlier, a couple things actually. So we're largely talking about kind of the scaling of the upper echelons of the regular Army. We had touched on the Reserve Officer Training Corps, the ROTC, mm-hmm. and you mentioned the National Guard, which at this point is still kind of half a state organization. We've not fully federalized it like it will be later. So how do they fit into this picture?
They are very much of a break glass in time of war kind of organization. They are very politicized in some ways. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because just if you have a state organization with commissions coming up from there, you cannot help but avoid it, right?
The governor's going to get his buddy to be the colonel.
As a for instance, the commander of the 35th Infantry Division up until 1939, 1940 was a guy by the last name of Truman.
Yep.
Cousin of the senator from the Armed Services Committee.
And the creature of the Pendergast machine in Kansas City.
So all sorts of... So the idea being that the Guard, and also the Guard, even is a local organization. So
right.
That's... And if you think... And again, as I said, if the regular Army is unfunded, the National Guard is doubly so.
Right.
And... So these division flags are present, and they are manned to a certain point. But this is not like the regular, the National Guard that we see today is highly professional, well trained, and mobilized fairly frequently.
Yeah, these guys you might find them down at the local Elks Lodge with a division guide on.
Possibly. Now this goes before World War I even. So when we had the 4th and 5th Texas, like this, when they were Texas regiments. This is in like 1906, 1905, where they had a rail car full stocked with beer for after duty hours.
I mean, it sounds fun.
Yeah, it's good, but you know the problem is just the level of training is not there where it should be, and it's not a fault of the organizations. It's just you can't do much without training, right?
And money.
So this is kind of where we're at, which is we've got a lot of division flags. We've got kind of the right officer. We've got a cadre of experienced and trained and educated officers kind of at that top level. But there's a whole lot of kind of filling in to do down at the bottom.
Right. Yeah, and if I remember correctly, this army is still only about 150,000 people, right?
It is exceptionally small. I'd have to go back and take a look at the number. But
a good chunk of that is on duty in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in... Some in the Philippines, Americans, not as much as you might think. We only really had but the Philippine division was really one of the only full, kind of more equipped divisions we had. Most of the overseas guys were staffed at high, were authorized to be closer to their authorized total strengths. Mm-hmm. Whereas most other divisions, you were lucky if you were bumping up around 25% of your authorized strength.
So this is a somewhat bleak picture, knowing that we will be at war in less than 5 years. So how does the change take place from, I think we've probably taken it up to circa 1935. The Roosevelt administration is very farsighted in that this is not the army we take to war in late 1941. So what's going to change in the late 30s as we get towards and then into World War II?
So... Interesting enough, the first thing they do is they actually do naval authorization. There's some naval bills that are passed. And
FDR's background.
Yes, and they authorize a lot You could say a boatload of naval construction.
Right.
I don't have the right notes in front of me, but it is a lot. They also start investing in aircraft design. The B-17 is developed in the 1930s.
So let's touch on that a little bit before we go back to answering the bigger question, because I know this is one of your stalking horses. When we read books about this period, the picture is often, particularly with new technology, things like air power, the picture is often the shining prophet Billy Mitchell telling the old fuddy-duddies that this is the future and them just ignoring him. What's the reality of things like the B-17 program?
There's a lot of promise in the new capabilities. The tanks are another one. There's a lot of promise in the new capabilities. However, the problem is that what you have with a lot of these prophets, and that's a lot of the interwar historiography is written basically as the morality tale, right? The prophets versus the reactionaries.
Right.
The problem is the reactionaries had, the so-called reactionaries, they had to deal with the world as it was in front of them. They had to keep the lights running and the organization happening.
And the planes keep crashing.
And the new technology is there, and it shows promise, but it's not there yet. So how much money do you invest in keeping some force structure intact while still not crushing this new technology? Mm-hmm. And some, like Billy Mitchell, what's funny is Billy Mitchell was really not court-martialed because he was a reaction, because he had, showed up things. He was court-martialed because he was a jerk.
Yeah.
And, you know, decided to be a jerk to people much senior to him. And, well, that ends badly. I don't care what you've done elsewhere.
Get you thanks for your service, yeah.
But same thing with the tanks, which is you got JFC Fuller and all these folks who's British, but sitting there going, tanks, tanks everywhere. And like, no, let's see what they're actually capable of doing. So as we're building up to this, they're still kind of fighting through this, trying to balance national requirements off of what's actually, what we think will happen in the future, off of what we can pay for.
Right.
And this is why you sit there, and this is why the first big authorizations and the first growth start to happen in kind of the reach out and touch someone categories. You buy a Navy first. Why? We're a continental island. It makes sense, right?
Right.
Okay, we're going to start investing in the Air Force, the Army Air Corps, I should say, at the time.
Right.
Because, well, it takes a little bit of time to train up pilots, and so that's got a longer lead time. There's an expectation that we can just draft a bunch of people and throw them into the Army. There's a little bit more detail than we can talk about that in a second, but the expectation is that the Army can grow faster than a Navy or an Air Force. And it's not entirely wrong that we do that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does take longer to train a pilot than it does an infantry soldier. Now, that you can exaggerate that, but that still is true.
Yeah. So as they start to build up with that. Now, George C. Marshall, who'd actually been the acting chief of staff of the Army through the summer of 1939, his first official day on the job is 1 September 1939.
Right.
Kind of an important date there.
Right. So the war has already started in Asia, arguably started in 1937. Now the war begins in Europe.
Right. And at this point, we're starting to kind of identify who we kind of want to do this. However, the Army is kind of picking this up. The United States Army, publish a new version of doctrine, FM 100-5, 1939.
And for people who are familiar with modern doctrine, this is the operations manual. This is now FM 30.
Right. And I believe this is kind of the first iteration of what was the famous 100-5 series that lasts all the way up until the 2000s.
Yep.
When we renumber everything, just to keep things interesting. And 100-5 is not really what I would call 1939 is not what I would call groundbreaking. It's basically a reprint of the 1923 manual, updated to account for some new technology and organization.
Like the tanks are much faster now.
Right. Tanks are faster. There's more of them. We're starting to play around with this idea of armor brigades. We haven't built armor divisions yet, although we're thinking about it. And all these things. Also, what's interesting is that this is also during the time frame when we start going from the old World War I style square divisions to triangular divisions. Very briefly, without going down a whole rabbit hole, the square division was designed to fight in the trenches of World War I. It had an infantry division, two brigades of infantry, and each brigade of infantry had two infantry regiments in there. So an infantry division had four regiments split amongst two brigades, hence square, two and two.
Yep.
And then they had an artillery regiment off to the side. Lots of extra capabilities. It was a very ponderous, big thing. We're talking 20,000 plus people.
Yeah, and if you're in a trench, you don't really need to move fast.
Right, and the staff can kind of think through their movements. However, we're starting to think about mobile warfare. What does that look like? We're starting to incorporate trucks more as we're going through these things. We're thinking through these problems. So they come up with a triangular division, which is they remove the echelon of the brigade.
Yeah.
They flatten the organization. So now that you have three infantry regiments, hence triangle, 1, 2, 3, working directly for the infantry division commander. But they also have the artillery regiment off to the side there. What they do is they strip out basically all the other enablers. Now I'm kind of squishing together several organizational changes which occurred over the span of really the next 3 to 4 years. But
right.
For our purposes, this will work just fine. And they kind of strip out a lot of the enablers. So what you have is you have a smaller division, but yet it's a little bit more mobile and flexible. As an interesting organizational point, if I've got 10 square divisions, but none of them are up to strength, and now I create triangular divisions, what I can do is I can move regiments around, I can move people around, and all of a sudden I've got maybe 5 triangular divisions, but they're almost up to strength. So we're getting ready to start, we're starting to bring divisions up to strength. And the idea being now fewer divisions, but we're starting to bring divisions up to strength so that if we have to push someone out the door for an immediate action, we've got something a little bit more than, well, we're at 25% strength and we can't move. Mm-hmm. We're now pushing a limited number of divisions up into the 75 to 80% strength. Now we're getting into the realm where they can actually do something if asked.
And if I remember the numbers correctly, from the 30s to 40, 41, we go from around 150,000 to about 1.5 million.
Oh, yeah.
There's a driving thing behind that the Roosevelt administration does.
Get to that in just a second. The other thing we're doing is we are updating our weaponry. We've been using the 1903 A3 Springfield, which is a wonderful rifle. It was introduced, you might guess, in 1903 or thereabouts. And it's a wonderful rifle. If you're a shooting aficionado, they are still some of the best target shooting rifles you can buy.
Yeah.
However, they're bolt action and they have a reasonably slow rate of fire. We are starting to buy the M1 Garand. This is a semi-automatic rifle. Has an 8-round clip that fits in there with an internal magazine. And that is a massive update. We're one of the only countries, I think the only country, to introduce a semi-automatic rifle mass produced into our armies. The Germans would introduce the Sturmgewehr and all that kind of other stuff, but in terms of mass produced to every soldier, an American rifleman is the only rifleman, I think, amongst the major combatants that is equipped with a semi-auto. And we're doing this in 1939. So Marshall is seeing this and he's pushing Congress to act because that's his role as chief of staff of the army. Interesting enough, this also makes him basically chief of staff of the Air Force, too, because the Air Force was part of there.
Right.
So
the land air forces, right? The naval air forces.
Or part of the Department of the Navy.
Yeah, it's complicated.
So he's actually a little bit more important than we might think of the chief of staff of the Army today.
Right.
Because what you have is that you've got the War Department, which has got the ground forces and the air forces. And you have the Department of the Navy, which has the Marines and the Navy.
Right.
So Marshall is not talking to a Secretary of Defense, which doesn't exist. He is the senior person who is talking to the Secretary of War or in many cases directly to the president.
Right, and it's also worth pointing out the Joint Chiefs don't exist in the modern form yet either.
That's actually an invention that it kind of gets its start in World War II. But the idea is that Marshall is trying to get something going, and he just can't make progress. What finally breaks the logjam is the fall of France. At that point, Congress goes, oh. And I think it's by like one vote. It's a ridiculously close vote. The United States Congress passes the first peacetime draft in American history, to my knowledge. I think that's correct.
Yeah, that's fair to say, because there had not been many drafts to that point.
The Civil War, I think, was the first one.
World War One. That's basically it.
Yeah, so this is the first peacetime draft in the United States history. And at this point, Roosevelt also mobilizes the Guard and the Reserve. It's called the Protective Mobilization Plan. And the idea is that what we're going to start doing is we're going to bring everybody onto active duty. Haven't talked a lot about the reserve, mainly because the reserve are basically, as you pointed out, I've got a headquarters with an empty building. And that was what they were, is that they were regular army officers who were there, who would then bring in draftees as they came through.
Right.
And so what we do is we bring everybody on to active duty, and we start getting people trained. Money starts to become available to train. Marshall starts to get these folks moving, and people start to fleet up very rapidly. Eisenhower famously starts as a lieutenant colonel in 1939. Simpson, who's actually a little bit senior to Eisenhower during this time frame, starts as a brigadier general, is very rapidly promoted to 2 stars and takes command of a division. He is going to also get in the interim command of training camp. But you start to see people move up rapidly. Also, what Marshall starts to do is Marshall starts to wield a pretty heavy hand with his officer corps. So we talked about these officers who are all served in World War I and were pretty salty and capable.
Yeah.
Well, if you were 20 or 30 in 1917 and now it's 1940, you do the math. Many of these guys are reaching kind of the end of their careers. They're 40, 50, 60 years old.
Or at least perhaps the end of their active campaigning careers.
Correct.
They can go be planners.
And Marshall's sitting there, and he puts a hard cap on age. And he starts reclassifying a lot of officers. Also, because we've activated the reserve, right? Who do we now have in there? All those people who had Reserve Officer Training Corps? Congratulations, welcome to the colors.
Yeah, probably the best thing the American military has ever done, creating ROTC.
As a West Pointer, I might disagree a little bit, but we'll roll with that. So, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
He now has more officers to choose from. He's starting to have a larger pool of talent, so he doesn't have to hold on to this guy because, well...
they make grades at West Point.
Yeah, it's like you're not doing the job, I'm going to get rid of you.
So he's instituting a meritocracy, at least to some degree.
As best as he can manage. Bearing in mind that he also has to fill a large number of slots. Right. But what he's doing is he's being very draconian about the age limit because combat is a young man's game.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is that a lot of these older guys, they're kind of set in their ways. So this is adapt or move out of the way. So you might be under the age limit, but if you can't adapt to Marshall's way of seeing the world and doing business, thank you for your interest in national defense. I'll take some up-and-comer who is more interested in this.
Yeah.
And if you've been somebody who's been in the job for 20 years, I mean, there you advantage of the guy's been doing the job for 20 years. The disadvantage is that person often is unwilling to think about new ways of approaching things. They're very set in their ways often. And when you need rapid change, it's not the person who's been doing it the same way for 20 years. You need someone with a fresh set of eyes on the problem.
Yeah. It's worth pointing out, too, that just like our kind of stalking horse of heroes and recidivist villains, this is not necessarily determined by age. Sometimes the old guys who've been in the job are remarkably flexible.
Right. So Marshall is coming in, and he's swinging a heavy axe.
Right.
Also, what he does is he starts As he's getting close to in 1440-41, he starts instituting a series of large-scale maneuvers. We talked about the Louisiana maneuvers. There were actually any number of army versus army maneuvers. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is that it takes time to get the to get the industrial base ready to go. The industrial planning is perhaps a whole nother podcast, but suffice it to say, the army had actually figured out how much industrial capacity was in the country. But they did not yet have authorization to start going to industry and cutting contracts.
Right.
They were able to up their orders, but they weren't able to start telling Ford, you're not making cars anymore, you're making tanks. Yeah. That will come, but not right now.
Yeah, and if I'm remembering correctly, it's not so much the Army that does that as it is the White House.
Correct, and that's an executive branch function backed by substantial legislative action as well.
Yes.
So we're doing these maneuvers, but we're doing maneuvers with tank brigades with might have 10 tanks. I'm exaggerating.
Some
but
cardboard tanks?
Or trucks with a placard that says tank on it. And they do these large army versus army maneuvers across the Carolinas, across Louisiana, across Tennessee. There's any number of where they're these doing these maneuvers. And overall, the U.S. Army doesn't do very well at them. I mean, Chris Gable's got this great book called the 1941 Maneuvers or something like that. In fact, I'm trying to blank on the name of the book. I apologize. But he highlights these. And overall, the U.S. Army, we do okay in some things. We see some things. One of the results is we come up with an armored division.
Yeah.
Because what we do is we kind of kludge the 7th Cavalry Regiment, which is the one mechanized formation of the cavalry, with the 1st Armored Brigade of the infantry, and we put them together into this ad hoc division, and it turns out it works pretty well.
Yeah.
So, and then they do it, and then Marshall sits down with them in AAR, and both the cavalry branch guys and the infantry branch guys go, gee, we'd do so much better if our branches would get out of our way. And Marshall goes, ominous dominus, there's now an armor force. It's a little more detailed than that. But the basic idea being is we're experimenting with all these things and we're starting to kind of move see how our units are doing. Now, this is not for Rifleman Snuffy. Rifleman Snuffy, by all accounts, is exceptionally bored by most of these operations. Because when you're moving...
Because he's sitting in a swamp foxhole watching a truck with a placard on it move.
Possibly. Or he's waiting for orders to move and the orders process. What Marshall's really doing is he's kind of starting to figure out who are going to be kind of his key players as he's going through.
More at the operational level.
Yeah, who are going to be his division commanders? Who's going to be his corps commanders? Who's going to be his field army commanders? And people who are doing well in these roles are kind of getting noticed, and also people who are doing well an echelon or two down.
Mm-hmm.
Because bear in mind, if you don't do well at the upper echelon, you'll get moved on. Someone else has to fleet up.
Right.
And it's still based upon seniority, but to a degree. So as Marshall's starting to do these exercises, he's realizing, wow, we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of Machiavelli in there, too, a little bit. He plans this right before the Guard and the Reserve are about to defederalize, because FDR only federalized them for a year. And then he comes to FDR basically saying, hey, boss, I think we need more time. And FDR says, yeah, you virulently, and extends it. Then Pearl Harbor happens, and all of a sudden Marshall's got more money than he knows what to do with.
So let's kind of break there and reassess. So we're doing this thing where we're scaling the military, we're building the army. We find out, you know, MDO is hard, which people find out at any time period in war. Now there is a war, but it's not necessarily the war that the army was planning for, because that war is in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that change any of this as we move through into 1942?
Not terribly, because the doctrine was actually remarkably flexible in a lot of ways. Also, the war was only in the Pacific for the Pacificans. A lot of the army still viewed that they were going to fight a war in Europe, and they had explicitly said so.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem that they now have is that the army that they have, which is about 30-something divisions once you add in the Guard and all these folks, is not going to be enough.
Well, it's worth pointing out, in early 1942, that Pacific Army gets overrun, as does the rest of the Pacific, and the senior officer there, Douglas MacArthur, is hiding in Australia.
Correct. I like that term, hiding. I'm not a huge MacArthur fan. But Marshall now has to figure out how we're going to massively expand the army. His planners come up with this thing called the Victory Plan. And the original idea is something like 200-something divisions. Now, I'm not going to walk you through the whole victory plan and all that kind of stuff, but suffice it to say there's a really good article called The 90 Division Gamble, written by Maurice Matloff, that kind of lays out the math. Yeah. Bottom line, we end up with about 89 division total troop bases.
So, real quick, what's the rationale for 250?
The rationale for the high number is the Soviets are going to drop out of the war, and we're going to have to joint force blend into Europe and fight Germany basically with us and the Brits.
So D-Day, except instead of 5 beaches, it's 50 and probably, 5 million?
Whatever the number might be, of course. Yeah. If you're going to do 50 beaches, how do you have the landing craft for? So
factories.
It still takes time. And but the idea is that they neck the number down, but they still have to create these divisions. And this is where the math gets interesting. Mm-hmm. Because now Marshall has to do two things simultaneously. And one of those things is actually twofold. The first thing he has to do is he has to push out kind of the initial wave to go fight. And those...
Fight where?
Well, glad you asked, which is why this is twofold. The first thing he has to do is he has to push out immediately. As you mentioned, the Pacific Army is basically wiped out.
Right.
He is going to have to push some combat power out to the Pacific. This will eventually take the form of the 24th and 25th Infantry Divisions, and which are formed from elements of the Hawaii Division and other elements out that direction. So less of a pull for the War Department, more of a pull for the Navy Department, but the War Department is still pushing combat power that direction.
Right.
He also is being told, and he is prepared to fight a war in Europe. So without going through the whole detail plan, there's some argument whether we immediately cross the channel, mm-hmm. To my French historian friend,
yes.
The channel, and fight in France, and the Brits basically say that you're insane. So we end up in North Africa for any number of reasons. But he has to provide combat power to do that. So that's going to...
So we got the two missions, right? We're flowing forces into the South Pacific, which will turn into the grinding fight on Guadalcanal, and then the grinding fights north against the Japanese kind of maritime forces. And I can't use the word grinding enough in the Pacific, which we forget includes lots of army forces.
Oh, yes. New Guinea is a fascinating campaign all in itself, or
yes,
series of campaigns.
And lots of dysentery. But we also have this thing where we're going into North Africa eventually by late 42. Now, you mentioned an important step. Our listeners are probably at least familiar with the campaigns, but I want to talk about kind of what's behind them. From the beginning, it sounds like what you're saying is England, the physical space of England, is the staging base into the continent, or maybe Africa. How does that work? How does the flow of forces into England and then into Africa or France or wherever, how does that work?
Okay, any amount of effort. So the first thing, there's a whole story in of itself there, so I'll give kind of the 40,000-foot overview. Is we have an American planning for liaison team in England even before Pearl Harbor. That after Pearl Harbor, that becomes formalized. The British actually come over. We have a series of conferences where we kind of hash out some details. And we have a headquarters that will become the genesis of what we will eventually know as the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt that Churchill and FDR have a tight personal relationship,
yes,
as well.
Correct.
What will be the genesis of the United Nations?
Correct. And so what you have is you have that headquarters, that nascent headquarters happening. So as you bring combat power over, that headquarters is meeting them at the beach, oftentimes with some British forces helping them at first, mm-hmm. welcoming them ashore, getting them into camps, getting them trained, getting them acclimated, or acclimated then trained is probably a better way to say that, and then prepare to do something else, because right now we don't know what that is.
So this is what we would now refer to as the JRSOI process,
right?
Right.
Joint Reception Staging, Onward Movement, and Integration. And the idea basically being is that you're receiving, you're staging them someplace. Onward movement is you're moving them to their attack positions and all that kind of stuff. And integration is when the unit is prepared to handle itself and move and fight the next phase. when these first couple divisions arrive in England, we're not quite sure what we're going to do with them yet. We're just going to push them over there,
right?
And figure that out as we go.
What happens once we get into the fighting, whether it's Africa or France or Italy or wherever?
Yeah, we'll figure that out later.
Right.
So there's another piece that Marshall has to do. So he's pushing combat power out. He also has to build combat power in the United States. Now he's got lots of draftees coming in, right?
Yeah.
The problem is how do I train draftees and get them ready to go in a timely fashion?
Right.
Because one can sit there like, oh, well, we'll train them until they're ready. Well, first off, you have to define what ready even means. Because everyone says, oh, the Soviets created a division in a week. Yes, and that division also took 100% casualties.
They are fine with shock divisions that die fast.
Whereas we were not ready to do that. So we have to get that division up to a level of training. We're also on a time scale. Today we call it TFID, time phase force deployment. I forget the whole acronym, but the idea being is that the division has to be ready to go at a certain point in order to meet theater requirements later on.
Right.
So the way he does this is he has a cadre of trained people in these formations already. So what he does is he has these divisions cadre out. It's basically kind of like, you know, cells dividing by mitosis. There's a very interesting question there, which is if you divide it entirely by mitosis, a division splits in half, and you have half a division, they take new draftees, and then the new half just brings in draftees. That's great. You'll have two divisions ready at the same time. The problem being is that your original division, which was getting close to being ready to go, is now nowhere close to being ready to go. And that's going to delay your training process. Now it's going to speed up the training process of the new one.
Right.
So it's kind of that proportion, right? The more trained personnel you send over in the cadre, the faster the training of that other organization will go, but the more you will harm the readiness of the donor organization.
Right.
So he's trying to square this circle with all of these different formations coming through. And he's got to get all of these and also the other thing too is how many of these forces do I need?
Right.
So he's got this assembly line of divisions that he is building up and ready to go, because as one of these newly formed divisions is ready to go, it can now in its turn slice off a cadre to form the next unit in the assembly line.
This sounds a lot like the imbrigating process of the French Revolution, where you took a volunteer battalion and stuck it next to an experienced battalion, but that was the highest echelon you did that with.
And we're doing this at the division level.
Right.
And so this is what Marshall is doing during this entire process, is that he is trying to figure out how to get sufficient combat power built
right
in time enough it does no good if you have the perfect army built in 1948.
Right, right. Now, for two wars, pointing out.
What's helping him is he has this cadre of experienced officer corps that we talked about that had been writing and all that kind of stuff. Troy Middleton, the eventual commander of 8th Corps, is an instructor. And he's like, and everyone's like, hey, we'll bring him back. It's shocking how many of these Corps and Field Army commanders had done instructor time. But what he's also doing is he's being exceptionally brutal with his senior echelons and kicking them out as needed.
Yeah.
One last point that kind of bears talking about as we kind of hit the hour mark, though, but it is worth talking about as we're building this force going into combat, mm-hmm. is the National Guard.
Yeah.
So we talked about how the National Guard was kind of out of had been kind of the bottom end of the barrel when it came to training and resources. So Marshall, now he's activated these guys. He then does something else, which is great for some people but bad for others, which is he says, hey, look, combat is a young man's game. Everybody that's over a certain age, and particularly married with children, I will offer you a discharge.
Yeah.
Demographics of the U.S. Army being what they are, the Guard has a huge percentage of people that fall into those categories.
Yeah, because they're the citizens.
Yeah, so they get pulled out of the force. So these units are now exceptionally gutted in terms of strength that they then have to get rebuilt. You also have the political problem of you have several division commanders who, rightly or wrongly, and there's a huge political fight over this, do not measure up to Marshall standards. of the 18 guard divisions, I want to say, 17 division commanders are relieved before they see combat. Just astounding number.
Which is something that would shock the modern military that does not really work like that, barring malfeasance or illegality.
Right, and it was just they didn't measure up, all that kind of stuff. And this is massive political problems that Marshall is having to deal with.
Because, as you mentioned, these guys are connected back home. They might be Trumans.
Yes, and or they might be brothers of the governor or all this. So he is having to deal with all of this as he's bringing the National Guard up. Now, some guard divisions are a little bit farther along than others. For instance, that first push that we talked about to North Africa included at least two National Guard divisions, the 45th Infantry Division and the 36th Infantry Division. Both guard divisions, the 36th being good old Texas boys, and the 45th being Oklahoma kind of southwest kind of guard as we go through there. Those two divisions are kind of the initial push out the door. And part of that is just those divisions, for whatever reason, they got plussed up a little bit quicker. They were ready to go quicker. There's lots of weirdness in terms of individual units as we look through this.
Yeah, for sure.
But what you see is that the guard, over time, loses its guard character.
Right.
Through, because you have all these folks come out. Like the 30th Infantry Division was authorized, I'm going to use round numbers just for simplicity, 12,000 folks. At a point in 1942, they were down about 2,000 to 3,000. So they're being filled in with all these draftees. So yes, the 30th Infantry Division is Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina National Guard, except not really by the time, 1944 rolls around.
It's a bunch of dudes from Jersey who got drafted into it.
Yeah, so it's an interesting character there. And the reason I highlight this is that the Guard is coming up into this as well and providing a lot of these initial entry forces that we're going to push out there because the flags are up and there and ready to go.
Which makes sense, yeah. So two final questions. First, did Marshall get it right?
He got it right enough.
Which may be the best you can
do. The answer is, as we take a look at these challenges, is that they're, as we look back at these decisions, did he get it right on every personnel case? No, we know that for a fact. General Friedendahl, who was commander of 2nd Corps at Kasserine Pass, was his first choice to be a corps commander in combat.
Didn't go so well.
Interestingly enough, Friedendahl goes back in as a training army back in the States.
Yes.
But gets promoted up, or gets fired up, yes. Maybe.
Failed upwards.
Yeah. So, but by the same token, the system worked and did the job sufficiently well, and this system, we can cover the details of kind of 1942 to 44 and 45 onward in another podcast perhaps, but the idea is that those initial kind of foundations that he built, that and the folks that he had to deal with, they did the job well enough to produce a force that was able to win the war given the circumstances they were in.
Yeah.
If we'd had to fight without the Soviet Union, if we'd had to fight with more contested air superiority, we're in a different world, but that's not the world he was living in, and he would have made different choices probably otherwise.
No, that makes sense. All right, final question. We live in a world of competition. We live in a world where China is our pacing threat. The immediate threat there is that China invades Taiwan, and the U.S. gets involved in a multi-domain conflict there. So what would you say the U.S. Army should learn from this case study of Marshall and the force management going into World War II?
Two things. Probably more than two things, but these are the two that immediately sprang to mind. First and foremost is whatever you think is going to happen will probably not be exactly what will actually happen. Mm-hmm. We knew we were going to fight the Japanese. We weren't prepared for the Japanese to do quite as well as they did against the Pacific Army.
Right.
Or the Pacific Fleet, might I add.
Right.
We didn't, in no universe, planning universe, did we have invading North Africa.
Right.
We thought we might invade Europe. What we really thought we were going to do is we were going to land at ports on mainland Europe and fight the Germans there. So that's got to change. So you have to understand that the war you're preparing for is going to be different than what you actually think it'll be.
That old Clausewitzian dictum of learn to live with chance and probability.
Right. What that means is that you cannot neglect your seed corn, which is those field grades that I talked about, the guys that had actually been captain, lieutenants and captains and majors and then in World War One, that maybe even a little bit higher, mm-hmm. those were the guys that built the force that won World War II. And in many cases, they were that force, right. just at the higher echelons.
Right.
So you've got to make sure that those guys have got the correct amount of training. And by that, I mean not just at the micro-tactical level. As much as those guys spent time in troop units, maneuvering battalions and all kind of stuff, Eisenhower famously never commanded anything larger than a battalion, I think. Maybe he might have had a regiment. I have to go back and take a look. But he did not do much. He was not a troop guy until all of a sudden he's the supreme Allied commander. And he's maneuvering army groups.
Right.
You see this repeatedly. So the idea of not just sending guys to see, this is Lieutenant Colonel Bill Nance, retired, speaking now a little bit more. But you don't want to send your up-and-comers only to the CTCs to look at brigade maneuver and brigade maneuver and brigade maneuver. You've got to get them into the MCT for the maneuver. Mission Command Training Program. There you go. I had maneuver stuck in my head for some reason. Mission Command Training Program, where we're looking at divisions and corps. You want them here in this building, at the Command General Staff College. You want them at the War College. Mm-hmm. You want them thinking the deep thoughts. You don't want them thinking just mechanically, how do I fight a brigade? You want them thinking, okay, how do I solve large, complex problems that are a couple echelons above what I'm playing in now?
Yeah, this is the challenge that is, I think, incumbent at every level of the Army, which is you have to train for your immediate task that you're going to next unit, but you also have to think about what you're going to be doing over the next 10 years.
Yeah, and that's so that's the kind of the two big things is, one, be prepared for the unexpected, and tied very closely into that is your seed corps matters.
Yep.
Those majors are students in many cases. If a war kicks off tomorrow, they're going to be the colonels and generals of the war. Oh, one last thing there.
Yeah.
Sorry, I forgot there. In the 1920s and 1930s, we thought we were going to be fighting large-scale combat operations. We knew that our army was insufficient to fight that and last for a extended amount of time. Therefore, the doctrine was explicitly expansionist. We sat there, the U.S. Army sat there and like, if we do this, there is going to be a draft and we're going to have to build the army from the divisions that we have now.
Right.
Bear in mind that in the 1930s, we had about 30 division flags. Maybe not 30 divisions with the people, but we had 30 division flags. We're going to have to grow that army into something much larger, and we built doctrine to accommodate a rapidly expanding army. If you look at all the manuals from that time frame, they're written to the third grade level, deliberately so.
Right, which probably closely matched a lot of soldiers.
Fair, which is good. So, and even the 100-5, written for majors and colonels and all that kind of stuff. It's like, so you're gonna fight an army.
Right.
This is what it does.
Right.
And that's what I'd say is
see army run.
So it works. When we talk about large scale combat operations, we need to think about how are we going to grow the force. You know, maybe not an explicitly expansionist thing of there will be a draft and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. but we've got to think about, well, what does large scale combat operations? Lots of people are going to die mm-hmm. in short order. So how do we keep ourselves in the fight for a protracted conflict? That's something that we need to start not just talking about in our doctrine, mm-hmm. but actually start practicing and rehearsing in our exercises.
Preparing for attrition. It's a very good conclusion. All right, Dr. Nance, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.